ከተማ ኢንፍሌሽን ቶፕ ወስ ባክ ነው ሾፓን ኢንፍሌሽን ሉክ ቱ ጋራንቲ
ኦኬ ጉድ ሞርኒንግ I was talking to Danny and all these guys that I'm not used to all this high technology going to send talks, but anyway, so just one correction. I belong to the UNAM University, that it's the University of Mexico, and this other one that is the local in Morelia, Universidad Michoacán. So whatever, it's just a sad news. Correction. Okay, so we will present these exit configurations for the automatization. And actually, this is my project that I have been working on for the last 2 years with people there in Morelia, with José Antonio Zapata, my supervisor, Axel Bieber, that belongs to this local university, and Robert Ogden from Christie. And okay, so I'm going to start. So the outlook talk. Okay, so the outlook for the talk is next. So I'm going to introduce you and somehow motivate this work. And then I'm going to say something about the preliminary notions, the mathematical structure that we're going to use. Of course, I'm not going to talk a lot of mathematics because it's not like very nice to hear lots of formal things. And then the most important thing that is going to be the Wilson randomization group. Applied in this context to group quantization. And at the end, I'm going to explain a little bit the first explicit examples that we have in our construction. And then, of course, the conclusion. Okay, so let's introduce this. So now, of course, I'm currently interested in loop quantum gravity is to understand more the dynamics that we have at the loop quantized level. And well, in this sense, we're proposing a way to understand these dynamics. That it's very nice because we are defining dynamics from effective theories and then we take the continuum limit of these effective theories and then we define the dynamics at the continuum theory, right? So it's just, we are going to copy the ideas of Wilson randomization group and then in lattice gauge theory. So all this work is based on the lattice gauge theory point of view. Okay, so of course, that we need in lattice gauge theory and Wilson randomization group and all these canonical approaches, or let's say standard approaches, we have a very clear notion of what is scale. We know how to measure things and we know all that kind of thing. But now, in this loop quantization, procedure that is intent, of course, to backward dependent theories. We don't know a priori what is the notion of scale. So for that, we postulate that extend the notion of scale, and then after postulate that, and after constructing the notion of scale, we apply the Wilson randomization group. Okay. And then, okay, one. This is one technicality that we will work with a truncation, and of course this truncation is going to be the space measures, and we will see that. And then we are going to construct the continuum limit, inverting the randomization group flow that we're going to obtain after the implement this prescriptions, okay, for the effective theories that relates to effective theories. And okay, so if the continuum limit exists, or in other ways, if we can invert this renormalization flow, then we are going to define dynamics in the loop quantized theory. So this is just a point to say that although this loop quantization is constructed to background independent theories, we can apply that as well to standard theories, as, I don't know, QE or something like that. And so theories that depend on a background matrix. So in that sense, our construction can be reduced to the standard Wilson renormalization. Okay. So I'm going to start with some preliminary notions. I don't know. First.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I was a little confused. You said you were doing this in order to define the dynamics. So, are you implying that the dynamics is not well defined unless one takes the continuum limits?
Well, we are going to define the dynamics in another way. I'm not saying that it's not well defined in this. It's not well understood. Yes. It's just another method to define the dynamics of the continuum limit. Okay, so it's just another method.
Okay. But in that list, I didn't see where the dynamics got in. So you'll assume some.
I'm going to say all the things. So can you just wait like 20 minutes or so? I can explain it in more detail, and then you will see it. Okay. So now all these preliminary notions, as I said, it's going to be just in order to define what is scale in our context. So basic stuff is the cellular decomposition. So to define the cellular decomposition, just take a manifold M, and then a cellular decomposition of a manifold is just a representation of it as a union of disjoint cells. So this is like the definition that we have here. And of course the cells are going to be open disk, or can be at the image of open disk of dimension 0 to dimension n. So we can think about, if we are thinking in R3, we can consider it like the interior of cubes as one of the three cells, the three-dimensional cells, and then the faces are going to be the two-dimensional cells, and then edges, and then vertices. So it's all this, you can think about that. But of course, it's like more general. So with these cellular decompositions, we are concerned with some specific type of cellular decompositions, which are the generic cellular decompositions. That is, if you take n points on the manifold and fix it, then we are going to be concerned with that kind of cellular decomposition, the compositions which has these points in some maximal cells. Okay, so if I'm taking, let's say, for example, if I'm working in a two-dimensional manifold, then I'm going to require that all these points that I have fixed lie on the two-dimensional cells. That's the kind of cellular decomposition that we are going to use.
Quick question. Since it's a union of disjoint cells, why would you pick one that lies on? What if one of those points lies on a boundary between two cells?
Then I just pick another one.
No, but the point is that she fixes P1 to PM first.
Yeah.
And then she's going to consider only those cell compositions which have that property.
So if for some reason I have one cellular decomposition that lies on the boundary of two cells, then that cellular decomposition doesn't work for me. Okay, so I just
Right, but every cellular decomposition, I'm confused about that. I'm just confused about the order of the logic. So do you choose one cellular decomposition?
No, I choose first the points.
You choose first the points.
Yes, and with these points, I just fix the points in the manifold, and then I choose a family of cellular decompositions that satisfy that always the points are going to be in the maximal cells.
So
I can choose it.
So when you make your construction, first you pick a set of points.
Yes.
Then you choose a cellular decomposition.
Yes.
Okay. So that explicitly breaks diffeomorphism morphism variance if you start by picking a set of points.
Yeah. Well, I pick those set of points because I just want to consider endpoint functions. But it's going to be part of my randomization prescriptions, okay? And I'm not really sure that breaks diffeomorphism
variance. Picking a set of points of endpoints over any other set of endpoints breaks diffeomorphism.
No, no, but you can change those points later on. So for any set of points that you choose, you can do the whole calculation, compute the correlation function, and then later on you can change those points. Actually, you'll do a different calculation with different cellular handouts.
Yeah, so that's why I'm confused. So, is the construction based on the fixed cellular decomposition, elite cellular decomposition?
Sorry, again?
So I'm just confusing it. So do you pick one cellular decomposition, or do you consider the
cellular? A family of cellular decompositions. That's what I'm going to talk about. So,
A family such that for any endpoints there is some cellular decomposition.
No. What she's doing is she's fixing. She's using arbitrary P1 to PN, which are completely arbitrary, and she's going to change them later on. But for the entire talk, most of the talk, those are going to be fixed. And then for those fixed points, she's going to consider a family of cellular decompositions obeying that property.
And
do a calculation, etc.
Right, so the construction based diffeomorphism variance, because
one construction does, but the family, but then when you start
but
carrying
the family of cellular decompositions.
But it's the family of cellular decompositions that fix end points.
Yeah, there's a risk of breaking
diffeomorphism. Okay, go on. Yeah. That's
okay, so. Once that I pick these generic cellular decompositions and whatever, I'm going to require other three properties in these cellular decompositions. One is a partial order relation that tells me that if I have two cells, maybe I can divide them. So let's say if I have two cells, C1 and C2, so something like this. And if I have some cell that belongs to C1 and some other cell that belongs to to C2, okay. So I'm going to require that if C1 is less or equal than C2, then C alpha is going to be a finite union of C beta. Okay, so this is my partial order relation, and then I have this. Cellular decompositions that are directed towards refinement. It's that if I have two cells and I pull, so there exists a third one that is bigger than the other two. And infinite refinement says that if I have an open subset M of the manifold M, so there exists such a cellular decomposition, the decomposition C0. Such that that is fine enough.
It's not legible.
So it's not. Yeah. Okay, what was research? So, property 3 is that take an open subset, an open, of M, and then, so there exists one cellular decomposition, the Z0, fine enough such that if I take one maximum cell of this cellular decomposition, then C, the C alpha, the cell, is going to be totally contained in U. Okay, so this is the third one, and actually it's a very nice property that gives me a sense of refinement of my cellular decomposition.
So, now I'm confused. So you say there exists C0 first, such that for every open set, it has a maximal C alpha.
There must exist some Z0.
Does the C0 exist before the U? Or you assume there exists one C0, such that for all
I'm considering a family of these.
Right, but your family is supposed to contain one particular member of that family, which you've called C0.
Yeah.
It's supposed to exist first, such that for that C0 chosen, for all U, you have this property.
Yes.
That's not what you wrote, because that's what you
mean. No, that's not what you mean.
I'm not sure.
For every given U, there exists.
I just pick one open subset of M,
and then
there exists a cellular decomposition such that.
Cells
is totally contained in the subset.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the last thing was just saying that all the cells get small for quality alone.
Yes.
The first one I just couldn't read. Is it the statement that for any cell in the less refined decomposition, it's exactly a union of cells in more refined decomposition?
Yes, it's a finite union of cells.
So it's not just that they're smaller, but they actually put together to make up a cell of a bigger decomposition.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So I think this is like the basic notion. Okay, so this is like the basic notions that we need for cellular decompositions. Of course, there exist many of these. We have some very nice examples, like there's something called the economic cellular decompositions, and other families that satisfy certain properties, extra properties, besides this one. But if you want, we can talk about that, but now I'm most concerned about this. So what is the abstract lattice? Okay, so given a cellular decomposition, I'm going to denote the set of its cells as L of C. And this is an abstract set, and that can be embedded into M just at will. A priori, we don't have any condition to put all these sets inside of M. But of course, that we need to keep the structure of the cellular decomposition fixed. So we need to have a sense of which cell is neighboring of the others and things like that. So so we have a natural map that embeds into M. And this natural map take one element alpha of some L to C to a point in the corresponding cell C alpha. So the cells C alpha are just elements alpha in L of C. I looked at this here. So actually, we construct this kind of of an abstract lattice in this way. So this is going, I'm drawing here the two-dimensional cells or the n-dimensional cells. It's a manifold dimension n. And then I'm going to map again a point in the two-dimensional cells of n plus one dimensional cells and so on. So I construct the lattice this way.
I'm confused. So we have two things. We have an abstract cell system and then we have an embedded one.
Yeah.
And then what do you want to map? Maybe just one drawing.
Yeah, so okay.
No, she's got an interesting set L of C, which where the alpha labels the subject decomposition has cells labeled by alpha.
Yeah.
So there's the abstract space.
Yeah. I mean,
at the beginning, C alpha was an embedded set. You define your cellular system as the cellular decomposition of M.
Yes.
So she wants to visualize alpha as a point in M. So she just picks a random point inside C alpha.
Yes, and then I put
alpha, therefore, as line as a point in M.
So you assign, that's an assignment to, for each alpha you assign a point.
Yes, that's what I said.
It's already embedded. Okay. And
then what about the arcs? What about the arcs? I mean,
what are all the, sorry?
And you do that for different dimensions. So,
yes.
So yeah.
For each cell, it's a independent space.
So sometimes alpha goes to a point. Sometimes alpha goes to no. It all goes to a point. So what are the lines?
All the cells.
So in your drawing, what are the cells?
What is a cell in your picture?
What is
a cell? A single cell.
A single cell in my picture is this. Okay.
Which one is this one?
I mean, the manifold is and then all these. I have a cellular decomposition that is this. Okay.
So what are the lines?
All this. And so that's just a picture of the abstract lattice. Okay. So now that I have. This is my cellular decomposition, okay? And so these points are the alphas that are embedded the alphas of L of C that are going to be embedded in M.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say I have this. This is just a cell in C alpha, okay? This. And then I have an alpha that belongs to L of C, okay, and then I'm going to associate a point in C alpha to alpha. That's the way I construct it. It's that here, so it's for all the alphas in the cellular.
But there'll be some other alphas where cells are of different dimensions from the ones you've shown there.
So that's the other thing. Let's say C beta, I'm going to associate another alpha, another beta, and in this n minus one cell, okay, and so on. I mean, of course, I can take, let's say, this point and associate the corresponding element of LFC. So that's how I construct the abstract lattice. In other words, broadly speaking, I don't know how to say that once that you have a cellular decomposition in the manifold, then you can embed kind of lattice, okay, for each other. it's just a lattice.
So the rules of the lattice are that if I have a top dimensional cell then the point which is chosen in it is, you draw a link from that to each point that's chosen in its boundary cells.
Yeah, you can say that, yes.
And those are the dots.
So I'm drawing these dashed lines just to say that this is, for me, that's going to be a lattice. In the future, if I want to construct, let's say, a theory on it, on this abstract lattice, and I will need something to relate the vertices of the lattice, right? Just like in the regular lattice theory, I need something to relate, and I need something to say, yeah, this has this correlation with this other point and things like that. So that's why I'm drawing this.
So at the moment, the dashed lines. At the moment, the dashed lines are just chosen. Every possible dashed line is put. Yeah. At the moment.
Yeah. So maybe you can forget about dashes lines. It's just an association of the cellular decomposition and this LLC. It is the set of
Is the dimension of the manifold is arbitrary, or is it?
Yeah, now it's arbitrary.
You said the mathematics too, but.
Yeah, I mean, just for say an example.
It's a dimension is an integer.
The dimension is, sorry?
An integer.
Yeah, but it's arbitrary. I mean, the dimension of the manifold is not an important issue. Okay.
Is this assignment respect the partial order? Should respect the partial order?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the implementation. It's going to be the very nice part. I know. So here we're going to work with a Cleveland description of quantum field theory, because it's better. We have a very nice understanding of Euclidean field theory. Okay, so that's and of course one of the motivations of working with this Euclidean description is that the model that I'm presenting here is just for spin systems and scalar fields and sigma models. So, but of course, we have another version of the other details that are not going to be that I'm not going to say here. It's are here. So for gauge systems, these guys have a paper on the peculiarity of gauge systems. Yes.
So you're not studying a quantum field boundary?
No.
So in that case, there is a metric on the manifold.
Yes.
So why don't you use the metric?
Up to now, I'm not going to use the metric. I'm just going to use the metric for a specific example. Okay.
So my confusion conceptually is, we already have well-developed normalization group descriptions for theories on manifolds with metrics. And so what are you doing that's not, say, just in the normalization group applied to a lattice, lattice spin system, which is very well-developed?
Yeah, I know that it's very well-developed. That actually, I'm taking that all that work as an example of my work. At the beginning, we take the same construction for gauge systems, okay. And now for scalar systems, I mean the main question is, okay, yeah, we know how to do these.
But also to get, I mean, the challenge has been to make a normalization description for quantum gravity.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's the main goal.
Yeah, and among the key challenges of that are the respective diffeomorphism invariants. So if you're only going to study models which have a background metric and have no diffeomorphism invariants, then already, I mean, you have a notion of distance coming from the metric, you have a metric.
Yes.
So why do you start with a general cellular decomposition? Why can't you just start with a regular lattice defined by the metric?
Because my main purpose is to apply that to quantum gravity, actually. So now I'm just testing his method to say that, to see if it works, at least in the simplest example. Of course, that if my method fails in the simplest example, it doesn't work to keep on working the method, right? So, of course, that the main purpose of this construction is to apply it to quantum gravity. Right, and now we're just testing this and trying to see if this is okay.
So my understanding is that she will present some skill which is general, which doesn't use any background structure, and then she will show also example how she can apply this to any model.
And the difference between fixing a lattice and this scheme is that she's specifically not fixing a particular lattice, which would definitely be a disaster for quantum gravity, but is considering all possible tether decompositions with it, which are compatible with the PI.
But is the distance scale based on a metric going to play a role in
No, distance scale is based on this.
On this money, no, for the cellular
decomposition. So cellular decomposition defines. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about this symmetry invariance of the cellular. Of the theories, we can talk about that later because it's a project that I'm doing. It's not included here, so maybe we can talk about it later. Okay. So, this is going to be my setting. So I'm going to say that this is A bar M is going to be the space of the Euclidean series, and its elements are going to be an assignment that for each point in the manifold, I'm going to associate an element of the group. And in the example that I'm going to work on is Z2. Okay, so I'm going to work with the spin systems. So anyway, that's my example. But in general, I'm going to say that this is going to be a function that associates group element to each point, right? So, and actually, it's no continuity requirement for this space.
The point being the guys you defined before.
No, how is it?
No, now this is.
This is a continuous.
This is the continuous.
Okay.
This is the space of the finite histories on M, on the manifold. Okay, so just take a point of your manifold M and then
put.
No, I'm not still on the discrete.
That's not the H2, is it?
No. Well, it can be if you take a group of a legal.
No, because your assignment would be to
if you look up there, it says for gauge systems.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now I'm going to set these to only to scalar fields. Species. So in this case, the space of the Euclidean history is going to be like that, the space configurations. Okay. So the space of observables that I will have is the algebra of observables. It's going to be the series of functions that, which are just functions that depend on histories restricted to finitely many points. So it's like the analog of the regular cylindrical function that you are used to. And our primary goal is to construct physical measures, that I'm going to call this UM on M, that involve the dynamics of the theory. So I have to say here that this UM is going to encode at the end the dynamics of the continuum theory. So it's very important, to keep that in mind. So now we are going to the discrete part, and we are going to define the space of Euclidean histories at the scale C, that I construct. What is the notion of scale that is obviously based in these cellular decompositions? As a configuration of a C constant configuration, so I call like that, in this way. So take an element of AC, and AC is going to be a subset in A bar M, such that if I take two points in M, then if these points are contained in the same cell, then I will have the same value of the function x. So in other ways, I would have that if I take just one cellular decomposition, so these functions are going to be constant on each cell. Right? So that's why I call that C constant, because this function takes just a constant value of each cell. So that's the way I.
But you can take independent value on.
I construct AC.
On a maximum dimension cell. So you take value on not on the maximum, but the.
All the cells.
All the cells. Okay.
Yes.
We can take different values.
Yes. 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 Okay. So this is going to be AC, and AC. AC is the space of C constant. C constant configurations and which I'm going to construct effective theories with that C, AC. So, of course, because of the construction of AC, this is in one-to-one correspondence to the space configurations in the lattice that I had already constructed. Okay, in the way that. Just assigning a point on each cell and whatever. So it's a very natural relation with this space of C constant configurations and the space of the space of configurations in the lattice. So now I want to have an effective theory at this scale C. And of course, because I'm working now in the lattice, I can think now that I can construct, I can just say a priori that I have a partition function in the lattice, and this partition function is going to give me the defective theory. Okay. What else? What else? I'm forgetting something. Okay, anyway. So now, given two different scales, there are two ways to relate the corresponding effective theories. Ah, okay, yeah, like that. So this mu c, that I have here is just the effective measure that I'm going to assign to the cellular to the effective theory at scale C, just by the partition function. So with the partition function, I can take expectation values of observables, and I can take endpoint functions and all that kind of things at the lattice. So in this way, if I can take the expectation values, I have a measure there, and I'm going to say that measure is going to be a measure, an effective measure. Okay, so and I'm going to call that MC. So once that I have the complete theory, that is like this pair of configurations at scale C and effective measure at scale C, I can now my question is, what is the relation? I have two differences of that decompositions that are related in the sense that I said before with this partial order relation and things like that. So, what are the relations between these two different effective theories? And now I have two maps: one that I call I C one C two, and the other one that is pi C two C one. So I call that I of C one C two. an inclusion map, it's a natural inclusion map of this space to the other. And the other I'm going to call is a coarse grain map. Okay? So actually I can define another inclusion map that goes from AC to AM. Okay? It's very natural because all these space of configurations obviously are subsets of the space of the continuum. Okay? And these induced regularization maps that bring any observable of the continuum to the scale C. So this is a very nice let's say function that it's actually it's a novelty here. Okay, and obviously because I have this regularization, I can think about that this space is going at some point is going to be dense in the space A of M, and I'm writing that feature as the limit of C goes to M of AC, it's A bar M. So in that sense, I have a notion of continuum limit in the space of configurations. Okay. So. Okay. So this is very nice. I like very much this. And the other one is a coarse grain map that models an average procedure just by means of an embedding. Okay, that I'm going to explain in the next transparency. But what this P does, in general, is just integrating out of the extra degrees of freedom that are not that has not the impact on the coarser theory, right? So that's the way P is in 2C1 works. Okay. Okay, so yeah. Okay, so now how can I choose this coarse grain map? Okay, so I first one have to choose this embedding, and there's a natural way to embed this too. And okay, now once that I have chosen this embedding, I can call P of I of C to C1 as a cool map of embedding. It is going to work here in space configurations. And actually I have another pi, that a coarse grain map that goes from the continuum to from a coarser theory to another pi that I always that goes from the continuum to a coarser theory. I think that it is. I need to check. But okay, I'm going to remember that.
So which way around? C1 has more points than C2, or?
C1, so.
Which one has the more points?
Yeah, I think I'm going to put this. Anyway. C1 is coarser than C2.
C1 has more points?
It means in the sense of refinement, right?
C2
is finer in the sense that it has more cells.
So then wouldn't that be the natural inclusion then? I mean, that will give you the R, not the 5. One way around is just the conclusion.
This is the point, okay? This is the point. The I is going to be.
So C2 is.
This one. Okay?
No, here's
better. Yeah. Here is better.
No, but of those two maps, one of them is just obvious just by viewing that as a subset.
So this is a final theory than this one. So I have this inclusion map that I'm going to call this regularization map that goes from the coarse theory to the final one. And the other one is a coarse grain map. So it has to be to the final one and.
No, I understand what you want.
Final to the coarse. Sorry?
I understand what you want on your diagram, but the question is how it's defined. One of those maps is the obvious one, just given by viewing the points.
My definition of the coarse coarse grain map is actually this one that I embed these coarse lattice to the final one.
Why do you have to choose that? I thought there'd be a subset. Why is it a choice?
Yeah, well, that's something that I didn't say, but there's a natural way, given two cellular decompositions that are related with this part of the population, there's a natural way to embed these two ones, okay? And there's other ways that are, let's say, consistent with all the requirements that I need. Let's say generate the decompositions, not that. So I have to say that this embedding is not unique.
It shouldn't be involved some kind of averaging. This way around.
This way around
should not be the obvious inclusion. This should be a kind of averaging procedure.
Yeah.
One map is simple. One map says that if I have a big lattice and a small lattice, then I can map fields on the lattice to fields which are constant on the defined lattice.
Yes.
So that's the other map.
And that's the map I. This map I.
Yeah. This is a coarse grain map.
That's
draw a picture, maybe.
Okay.
Then you define it on the sense of fields.
Yeah, so. Imagine that I have
so certainly the first
a lattice. Sorry? So imagine that I have four this two. And I have the other lattice. Like that. Okay. So this is going to be L of C one. So there are some requirements of embedding of this coarser lattice to the final one. Okay, but you can think about I'm going to choose the embedding of this lattice here in this way. Okay, and now.
So you have a choice because they're all subsets of M. I mean, the actual.
No, but for every bigger cell, there are four small cells inside. So you choose one of those small cells. So it's not natural. You have a choice.
It's not canonical.
Right.
It's not canonical. So you have to define which small cell.
Yeah.
Yeah, which cells are going to be in the bigger one. But let's say now I'm going to choose the million in this way. And the coarse grain map is that. I mean, I'm going to integrate all these extra degrees of freedom in the coarse grain map, right? So I don't need the extra degrees of freedom here. Yeah.
Can I clarify your use of the word effective theory? So it seems to refer to situations where the effective theory is obtained by a single coarse graining of the type you're describing. Yep. So if I, like the classicalizing system would do, but if I'm not thinking of something like a spin chain, where the effective degrees of freedom are the spin waves, that presumably does not fall into the style of including the observables at all scales into the smaller observables, right?
I think I don't understand your question. Can you repeat me again? Sorry, I was.
So
I know that it's So I mean, clear with the ISO model, yes.
Right, yeah. So I can see how it can work with a classical ISO model, because the theory plus the larger spacing is obtained by integrating out the smaller degrees of freedom. But in general, what we think about effective theory might not have this direct relationship. So I'm thinking of a spin chain where the effective degrees of freedom are spin waves. Now, in that case, I'm not so sure how I would fit that type of effective theory into what you have there. The spin waves are not a coarse grain of the smaller spins.
Depends on the coarse grain procedure. So if you take the fine box and average in a particular way, take the neighboring box, you might get something in the coarse grain box that looks like a wave.
That you have to take at least half the spin chain to get a spin wave.
Yeah, you would have to.
So, but then you have a big jump, right? It's not a chain of observables at different scales. Take the example of a phase transition. It's even more clear that it would be very different, right? You still call the theory in the other phase an effective theory, but you don't have a sequence of theories at different scales.
Would that depend on the cost of any
procedure? Sorry, maybe you should let her explain what she's going to do with that, and she's going to show an example.
Yeah, maybe it's an example
that's there. Okay. Anyway, not to further interrupt too much, your question is a general question on the whole procedure of Wilsonian renormalization, I think. I don't think it's specifically directed to this variation on this thing.
I would just like to understand what one means by effective theory. So. It means that
I think
it
you can theory at scale. I think you can read effective theory to be theory at scale C, where C is defined by a particular cellular.
I mean, it's the idea of Wilson, right? Wilson does is just integrate out to a certain scale in the energy, right? And then here you say, yes, I have an effective Hamiltonian. No, I have an effective theory, whatever. It's in the same sense, okay? Yeah.
So just a clarification here. I mean, everything we're doing is based on there being a metric. I mean, the mu's, which are the partition functions, say if you're doing, chiral model with, the five values of mu1 or something like that, there's a continuum action. Continuing Hamiltonian underlying this. When you say the coarse grain, you integrate in the measure given by the metric on a manifold, presumably.
No, she has a measure in the space of fees. Mu or C.
Yeah, but mu depends on the metric on the manifold.
She has to show an example.
It depends. I mean,
or the theory of strength.
Yeah,
it depends on the theory, right? I mean, I did construct. If I want to apply this method to the bulk of dependent theory, obviously my partition function is going to depend on this, and the measure is going to have some dependence of the metric. But now let's think more about bulk of dependent theory. So the method doesn't rely on any bulk of structures. Right, and I can construct a partition function, I can construct a metric in, a measure in the effective theory. I mean, that's doesn't have anything to do with the metric, I think. I mean, I think that the effective theory, the way I construct it, is just depend on the. So I'm going to consider a sequence of coarse grain cellular propositions, okay? So this sequence is going to be increasingly finer, and I can do that because of the properties that I just mentioned at the beginning. And now two observables in the sequence are linked exactly because of these two different maps that I have here. So the coarse graining map let us use a microscopic theory,
yeah,
to evaluate the expectation values at the microscopic level. Okay, so that's how can I relate the same observable to two different effective theories, right? So this gives me at the level of the measures this equation. So now, why I'm writing this with this more or less equal, approximate equal. So I can have this equation in an exact way, and that is going to be called the exact randomization group transformation. Actually, this pi is the in the language of people from high energy physics. This is a randomization group transformation. It's a coarse graining map, and if I want this to be exactly equal, so I would have another measure that is completely determined by this final measure in the final scale. Okay, but it turns out that this measure is not the same functional form that the one that I began with. So if one wants to work with this with this effective measure at the coarse scale, one can work, but it's somehow like more difficult. And of course we don't want it. So on the other hand, we can just work with a truncation in the space of measures and say, okay, so I have one type, let's talk about the icing field, icing type measure, and then I coarse grain, but then I make my renormalization transformation, and then I'm going to ask and I'm going to require that the measure that I get is going to be as the same functional form. So that's the truncation, that's a very strong requirement, but people usually do that, and the people who always do this kind of thing, the normalization stuff, they always work with a truncation. So that's what I was talking about for this prescription. Yeah. So this tells me that MC1 or μc1 is going to be the best approximation of this μci1. So that's the way I can. So the thing is that with this Wilson randomization group, the thing is that one that I keep one functional form of the measure fit, I can just go into the coupling constants that so the coupling constants that define my theory in some way. That I'm just writing here just one, but you can consider that as a bunch of coupling constants. And I want that these coupling constants are related for each theory. So if I have the question that I wrote before, that MUC1 is something like the transformation map and whatever, and then the formula, this equation, I can get an equation for the flow of the coupling constants. So I need that this coupling, the equation can be iterated for each step on the effective theories, yes.
Yeah. So you start off by saying the relationship between the different C's are a partial order, not a total order. So what if I have a partial order, I can go between a first and a final one by going this way or that way?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have anything that guarantees you get to the same place.
Yeah, well, because of, I mean, if you're talking about the exact randomization confirmation, yes, you don't have a warranty. Okay? But
you know everything you want.
But yes, of course, if I'm working with a truncation, I will always want that.
There's nothing to do with the truncation, and the point is, what makes the Wilsonian normalization group work is that it's a total order. There's
yes.
a scale, and you know, there's a ordered sequence of theories.
Yes.
By Feynman and Mencken. If you have a partial order, then you have the issue of the non-commutativity of going different ways through the partial order. And
I
that's.
I think it doesn't.
If I have a map from here to here, from this theory to this theory to this theory to this theory, or a map from this theory to this theory to this theory,
I mean, I'm
it's
just
a partial order, so there's no relation between these in the middle. Okay? Then you have no reason for the maps to take you to the same measures.
No, you have the same measure. I mean, if you're working with a family of pseudo-random transitions that are just a nested family of pseudo.
So that's a total order.
Okay.
That's a total order, not a partial order.
I think your statement is that you work with the exact normalization because you're integrating.
But then
it's exact, right? So it doesn't.
For a total order.
No. For the full order.
No. The bi-harmonizing model.
I think she's saying for the exact normalization group, it doesn't matter because you're integrating out. So if you're integrating out one way or the other way. But now when you do the approximation, then it really matters. What you're saying is when you truncate the normalization group, then of course the truncation is not going to commute. So
the sufficient provision is that for two different cellular decompositions, there is a single one which is a refinement of all of them.
Yeah. That was the second assumption, the direct was refinement assumption.
Yes.
Yeah.
But these, right, as soon as you truncate your theory, and you look at the space of truncated theory, now you're not going to commute, right? So at the exact normalization group level, I think it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as soon as you truncate, then you need a total order, or otherwise you're. So the truncation is not possible in the free setting. That's the problem. That's the key problem.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that.
I
don't want to contradict you. I mean, I just want
well,
to say
you
that.
Check an example.
Yeah. I just want to say that it depends on one of the family of cellular decompositions that you're taking, and two, that I mean, the truncation just gave me a special type of measure, right?
Yeah,
that I want to keep all orders. If you integrate one, then integrate two, or integrate two, integrate one,
we all commute. But if you integrate truncates, then it doesn't commute. The point of
one.
So the truncation is a very drastic.
It's a very drastic. Yes, I know that.
And there, it makes sense somebody should have thought a lot.
Yes, of course, but that's exactly the same problem that you have with the standard randomization
group. No, but the standard.
Because you always make a truncation.
The standard normalization group, your normalization process is divided by the scale of your lattice.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if you make this exact randomization transformation, you will not have a measure of the same type, even in fundamental theories, and then you need to.
We're talking about the commutativity. If you have a total order, the question becomes: you don't even have to ask the question, right? Because there's only one way to go from one to three by going through two. If you have a general context, you have many ways to go from one to three, and there.
Yeah, well, I really don't know.
I think you're interested in the continuum limit ultimately, right?
Yes.
The continuum limit, you hope, in the usual setting, you hope that the details of how you truncate don't affect anything.
I think
that here you hope that the commutativity will also return in the
I'm not saying I actually think that she's abandoning her general scheme at the moment. She's saying consider a family C1, C2, C3. In that family, you actually have a linear ordering. So you're not talking about the schema. You're talking about two sequence, CI. Within that sequence, you have a truncation, you have a field ordering, or you have a well-defined, or not perhaps well-defined truncation. This issue doesn't arise. Okay, just talking within the context of a given sequence. I know that it's more difficult to talk about the
An extended notion of scale in this context, right? But it's more difficult to explain. So anyway, so I was talking about the equations for the coupling concepts, right? So I can somehow iterate if I have a truncation. Otherwise, I cannot, and then I cannot have a flow of the equation of the coupling constants, right? So I don't have a equation flow. But if I truncate it, I can have a very nice relation with these guys, and then that's what I call the randomization flow. And here comes a very subtle point that if the resulting flow in the space of coupling constant, can be inverted, in another way, if the transformation can be inverted on the other side, going to the continuum, or going to finer and finer and finer and finer scales, then I can talk about considering a flow of the coupling constant towards the continuum. And I think that it's very subtle because you cannot always find this inverse of the transformation. So I have to say that this is a very subtle thing. But at least in our example, everything is okay. We can invert this transformation, and we can reverse the order of the flow. Okay? So now my hypothesis is going that effective theories at finer scales are going to be more precise. In other words, are going to be better approximations of a theory at the continuum. So let's say if I take a cylindrical function of the continuum, and then I calculate I just make a regularization of this function to a scale C, and then I compute the expectation value of this function, it's observable, whatever. That I don't usually, I know how to do that. Then the effective theories are going to define a continuum theory if the sequence of all these values are going to converge. In other ways, if the limit is very well defined, the limit is just the conventional limit. I don't know, maybe like in the conventional sense with epsilons and things like that. It's like if you take epsilon, a positive epsilon, then so there exists a fine enough cellular decomposition C zero such that F n minus the regularization of this f at scale c, it's less than this epsilon for all the cellular decompositions in noise family that are finer than this epsilon. So this is just the conventional definition of limits. So this this limit tells me that if I get into finer and finer scales, I will have a better approximation of what is going to be this Fm. So actually, I'm defining the measure in the continuum by means of this limit. So this is like very nice. And obviously, if this limit exists for every cylindrical function, then we have constructed a definition of a functional, and it's in the space of configurations in the continuum. So now I have to say here that this way of constructing the measures at the continuum, that's obviously a new way of constructing that, and it's very different from the projective limit. And because I'm using here these regularization maps that are completely new and not the other one. Actually, the other one, the coarse grain map, is somehow related to the projector that is used in the projective limit. So, I'm just saying that, I'm using this regularization map from the continuum to some coarser theory, or an effective theory, and this older map, P star, is the one that is somehow related to the projective limit that we are used to. Okay, so.
So, can you take the continuum to be truncated, or is it any truncation?
This expectation value is taken with a truncation. Okay, so once that I have my new, let's write it down.
Well, it's one of the nice retro sequence. I mean, point is you have different sequences all have coming to n in the limit, and you will get different answers. Let's see. That was going back to this point. You could think of you would define it all for a sequence C1, C2, C3.
Yep.
You could imagine the sequence getting finer and finer, yes, and becoming eventually n.
Mm-hmm.
And that then you have the limit might not exist. But then for some different sequence also becoming n, you could have a completely different answer.
So I understand that third condition is that it should be the same for every sequence. And you say
it's not a condition, it's not, I mean it's a hope.
No, it's not.
I'm
saying that my hypothesis is that if I get to finer scales, I will approximate there my expectation values of functions. That's my hypothesis.
But this is a theorem in normalization. If you have a theory of the metric and you do coarse grading, then you know that the corrections are going to be higher derivative operators and so on and so on. So with certain property, this is a usual theorem of randomization group, that for certain class of theory with certain total order, then truncation is in details of the lattice do not matter. So that's why we call it's not an hypothesis, it's something that comes out of the analysis.
Yeah, but here I wanted to just summarize here in this triangle that I have, but I think that I would not have enough time, so I'm going to skip this. Anyway, so this is my explicit example. Okay. And this is an interacting local theory, spheres. So my Euclidean, my space of Euclidean history is just going to be A bar of R2. So I'm talking now about three-dimensional manifold, and my manifold is simply R2. And the system course, it has a coherence, a physical coherence length. So now I'm talking about the Barbour matrix. It's just an example. I have to say that. And I said at the beginning that if I apply my method on the Barbour dependent theory, everything is like more or less similar to the the standard randomization. Okay. So, but now I just want to translate all these into my language. Okay. So I'm going to use familiar cellular decompositions that are going to be these C, M, T with M in naturals, running the old naturals. Of course, the Barcel order relation is going to be that if I have a bigger M, so I have M less than or equal than N, then the cellular decompositions are just one finer than the other. Okay. And this order T is going to be specified once that I choose the set of points that I set before. Okay. So these families are just called the Cartesian regular cellular decompositions, and they have a size that is something like that is exactly AM, it's 1/2 to the M. So you can think about the cells of these lattices as just squares, and squares with the boundaries, squares with edges and points. And now we are going to use endpoint functions. And for this, I'm going to pick endpoints. And then for these endpoints, I'm going to choose a specific family with this T that I have here. So T moves or shifts a little bit in order to have to have a generic cellular decomposition for the fixed endpoints that I chose before. And now I have the definition of the endpoint functions at the scale C. And then this tells me, let's say, I have over here, I think that I have the okay, so A of L, alpha of 1, and alpha of F, and also the cells of the cellular decompositions. And what I have is how many this and S of alpha is going to be S of alpha of P. So I'm considering here that this alpha contains the points that I chose before. So this is points of this. And this is like the standard definition of the partition function. And this is just the magnetization for the spin system. Okay. And now a single step in the coarse graining map is defined here with the coarse graining for 1m plus 1m to 2m. So what I'm doing here is just I'm going to embed this cell into two cells, well actually four cells. And in other words, I'm just coarse graining half of the rows and half of the columns. But this is my language, so I need to specify the embedding. So once that I chose embedding, I can get my coarse graining and my coarse graining of endpoint functions, just like that. And the fallback of the endpoint functions at scale, at one scale, and this is, I said that this is, this is the exact renormalization transformation. Okay? So, this is something that. That I just need, and of course I'm going to make a truncation there. So my randomization description is going to be this: that I'm going to fix the correlation length, the physical correlation length is going to be fixed, and this is the correlation length for each scale, and this is the the length that tells me in which scale am I. And this comes from the z comes from the partition function, and I'm going to ask that this remaining variables coarse grain transformations, okay? And then I have a theorem from McCoy and Tracy and Wu that says that if I choose this renormalization prescription, I will have a well-defined continuum and is this. I have explicit formulas for this, but there are like very complicated to write down in a slide. So this is a very nice proof, and it was done in the 70s. So actually, we are just using this theorem to say, yeah, we have a continuum measure. I mean, we have an endpoint function defined on the space of configurations A bar M, or in this case, A bar R2. And it's very well defined. And actually, it is for the endpoint functions, all the endpoint functions are very well defined in the continuum meaning. So that's like the main and the most important theorem here that tells me that, yeah, I can construct it in the way that I want. This continuum limit and the endpoint functions. Actually, the endpoint functions are just linear functional in this space A equal M. And now I what? Just stop. Okay. So I think that I'm going just to take the conclusions. Seconds. So the conclusions are just that I can construct dynamics from a very systematic point of view, and actually I can reconstruct ones that I have in the endpoint functions. I have theorems, a presence of theorems. In the case of the theorem, I have the Osterwalder theorem that tells me how can I reconstruct this to have a covariant theory at the continuum. So one of the things is that we have to find a Lucondized theory at the continuum level, and would be very nice if we can realize, at least in this example, it would be very nice if we can have a relation between the standard realization of the Ising-Field theory, that is a fixed four-dimensional Kingsburg model. Standard field, the scalar field, and this other theory that I have defined, the continuum, that is a loop effect theory. Okay, so it would be very nice if we can have a connection, because we have obviously we have the same endpoint functions, but we really don't know if these two different representations are unitarily equivalent and things like that. So this strategy can be applied to gauge theories and political theories. And of course, my main goal is to apply that to quantum gravity. And we have some ideas for that. But still, it's like on the construct. So that's all the things that I wanted to say.
One point when you were discussing the continuum limit, you said the criterion was whether or not the renormalization group flow is convertible. Do you know any way of deciding whether it's invertible or not?
No, I wish I know. I mean, I know that there are some theories in the standard quantum theory that doesn't have it. I think that fixed point in the ultraviolet field. And if you don't have that, then you can, it's not like very nice to talk about continuum limit, because test. I really don't know what should be the criteria. I need to look more because I'm really interested in just see what are like the precise criteria to say I can invert the randomization procedure. But of course, what people usually do is just they restrict to say, okay, I have to say one thing, that when you do this exact randomization transformation, you say that all the endpoint functions are must be equal, right, in different different scales. And that's very strong, and that's why you don't get like the same functional form of each scale. But if you want to truncate, one thing is to say, and you want to go to the continuum, then to just say, I'm going to keep some of the endpoint functions equal to each scale, and this one are going to be the same number as the variables, as the copies that I have to make invertible this transformation. But that's the only thing that I know. So,
Can I ask a quick question to everybody, not all speakers as well, just a very quick one. Just in the McCoy theorem, you compute, you have this well-defined theory in the limit.
Yeah.
What does that theory look like in the sense, is there an effective, like a star product, an effective theory which describes that? In other words, when you work out that effective theory, can you describe it as an ordinary, as a simpler theory with some new product, like a star product.
The
effective
theory
of
the continuum.
Yeah, in the continuum. Does that theory have a simple description? Very typically, in other contexts, in non-geometry arising, mm-hmm. because the effective theory is very complicated in different terms.
Yes.
But you could write that as a simple theory with a star product, with a modified product.
You know what I mean?
Well, never mind.
No. Sorry.
Yeah. So, let's thank Elisa again. Beautiful. Please, if you have any questions.